just as the Stone Age ended with a lot of stones still on the ground. Yamani knew that the price signal, the price of oil versus the price of renewables, was everything, and OPEC needed to keep its crude prices exactly at the level where the cartel could earn the maximum returns without spurring the West to innovate any scale alternatives to oil. Our goal needs to be to make Yamani's nightmare come true. The way to do that is by creating our own price signal to trigger the market to launch those 10,000 innovations in clean energy in 10,000 garages and 10,000 laboratories. The market will give us what we want, but only if we give the market the signals it needs. A carbon tax, a gasoline tax increase, a renewable energy mandate, or a cap and trade system that indirectly taxes carbon emitters, or some combination of all these. Nate Lewis, the Caltech energy chemist, employs a very useful analogy to explain why exactly taxing the dirty fuels is so critical in order to stimulate massive innovation in and deployment of clean power. It goes like this. Let's say I invented the first cell phone, and I came to you, dear listener, and said, "Have I got a deal for you? I have just invented a phone that you can carry in your pocket." You would probably say, "Wow, a phone that I can carry in my pocket? Really? That would change my life. I'll buy 10 and pass them out to all my employees." I'd say, 10 it is, but I have to warn you, this is the first generation model. They're going to cost you $1,000 each. You would no doubt say, "Sounds like a lot, but it'll be worth it. Like I said, a phone that I could carry in my pocket would change my life." So I sell you 10, and I sell the next listener 10, and the next listener 10. 6 months later, guess what? I am back with a new version of my little cell phone. It's smaller, lighter, and costs only $850. I'm on my way down the learning curve. Now I am on a roll. So I go back to my innovation lab, and this time I invent a solar-powered light. I come back to you again, dear listener, and say, "Remember that cell phone I sold you? Worked out pretty well for you, right? Well, now I have another deal. See that light fixture above your head? I am going to power it with electrons created by the sun. But this is brand new technology, and it's not cheap. It will cost you an extra $100 each month to power your light fixture that way." And what would you say back to me, dear listener? You would probably say, "Tom, remember that cell phone you sold me? Now, that changed my life. I never had anything like it. But in case you haven't noticed, there's already light coming from that fixture above my head. It works just fine, and frankly, I really don't care where the electrons come from. Sorry, Tom, but I will pass." There is only one way to change that outlook. The government needs to come in and tell you, dear listener, that from now on, you are going to pay the full cost of all the CO2 and pollution from your incandescent coal-powered light fixture, and therefore, it is going to cost you $125 more a month to turn on that light. Then my solar-powered light for only $100 more a month looks like a bargain, and you'll take 10, and so will all the other listeners of this program, and 6 months later, guess what? I will be back with the same solar lighting system for only $75 more a month. I will be down the cost-volume learning curve, and, innovation being what it is, I will eventually get that solar light cost below that of the coal-powered one. I will have taken my new innovation to scale. Everyone says that building a renewable energy infrastructure is the moonshot of our generation. I wish. Building an emissions-free energy infrastructure is not like sending a man to the moon, explains Nate Lewis. With the moonshot, money was no object. and all we had to do was get there. But today, we already have cheap energy from coal, gas, and oil. So getting people to pay more to shift to clean fuels is like trying to get funding for NASA to build a new spaceship to the moon, when Southwest Airlines already flies there and gives away free peanuts. I already have a cheap ride to the moon, and a ride is a ride. For most people, electricity is electricity, no matter how it is generated. Making cleaner energy doesn't provide them with something new. So, you are asking them to pay for something they already have that does the exact same thing. Nobody would be buying iPods in the numbers they have if their cell phones could already download music. The critical thing to remember is that clean energy gives you a new environment, but not a new function. Electrons are electrons, not blue or green electrons, notes Lewis. They all just make the light bulb white. They don't search your email, and they won't correct your spelling. Therefore, I repeat, if we want to get both forms of innovation at a large scale, breakthroughs that lead to whole new ways of generating clean electrons, and breakthroughs that come by getting the clean power technologies we already have down the learning curve faster, we need the government to level the playing field by taxing what we don't want, electricity from carbon-emitting sources, and subsidizing what we do want, clean power innovation. That's what will create the market demand we need at the scale we need. In 2000, the International Energy Agency produced a report, Experience Curves for Energy Technology Policy, that underscored how, if government increases demand by using price signals, it can move existing technologies quickly down the learning curve and get much bigger deployment at lower costs much sooner. With historical annual growth rates of 15%, photovoltaic modules will reach break-even point around the year 2025, said the IEA study. Doubling the rate of growth will move the break-even point 10 years ahead to 2015. If we want cost-efficient CO2 mitigation technologies available during the first decades of the new century, these technologies must be given the opportunity to learn in the current marketplace. In other words, we need new stuff. We absolutely do. But the old stuff, wind, solar, solar thermal, and geothermal, is here, and it works. If we can just stimulate the market with the right price signals to get them down the learning curve faster, they could make a very big dent right now. All you have to do is watch how prices of solar panels and wind power have steadily fallen around the country as the market demand for them has expanded. Manufacturers take advantage of economies of scale and learn new ways to produce solar panels or wind turbines more efficiently. But they still have a ways to go to be competitive with coal. That's why we want to expand the market for these existing renewables even more. And that is why I focus on the market, not on a Manhattan Project. The analogy of a massive government Apollo program or Manhattan Project is so flawed, argues Joseph Rahm, the energy physicist. Those programs were to create unique, non-commercial products for a specialized customer with an unlimited budget. Throwing money at the problem was an obvious approach. To save a livable climate, we need to create mass-market commercial products for lots of different customers who have limited budgets. Only a properly shaped market can do that, added Rahm, and we should be creating that market right now, rather than just hoping and praying and betting the farm on some magic, totally new breakthrough for generating clean electrons. I love magic. We need a magic breakthrough. Close your eyes and pray that we will find one soon. But in the meantime, let's open our eyes and see all the clean electrons that can be generated from existing technologies hiding in plain sight. if we create the right price signals in the marketplace to get them to scale. The price signal we use may not even have to be a tax. It could just be a floor price. When crude oil was $50 a barrel, the U.S. Congress wouldn't have dared to impose $50 a barrel tax and make it $100 a barrel. But now that it is over $100, and this is stimulating more investments in alternatives, the government could declare that it is imposing a floor price of $100 a barrel. If oil stays above that, fine. If it goes down to $90 a barrel, the government will add a $10 tax. It could fix a similar floor under gasoline at $4.50 a gallon. This would remove a big source of uncertainty from the shoulders of energy investors. If inventors and venture capitalists believe that the price of their new clean energy invention can always be undercut by the dirty old alternative, we are not going to get new innovation at the scale we need. And we are not going to get existing clean power technologies down the learning curve at the scope we need. After the oil price spikes in the 1970s stimulated enormous innovation in solar and wind power, the OPEC price collapse a decade later wiped out all these investments, and governments lost interest in supporting them. Companies and investors have just seen this play too many times. They are still wary, even at the current price of oil, that they will make a big bet on renewable energy and then the benchmark oil price, now over $140 a barrel, will fall to $75 or even $50 a barrel next year. The market for alternatives will disappear, and their company will look very foolish to its shareholders. Consider Toyota. As I record this program, there is a 3-month waiting list to buy a Prius hybrid in America. Why? From the beginning, Priuses have been manufactured in Japan and then shipped here. Sales of the Prius go up and down in tandem with the price of gasoline. When the price of gasoline soared to $4.50 a gallon across America, demand for Priuses went through the roof. Yet only in July 2008 did Toyota announce that it intended to expand some of its Prius production to America. But not until 2010, at a plant in Mississippi originally designed to build SUVs. I guarantee you, if the White House had instituted a Patriot tax on gasoline after 9/11 or set floor prices for oil and gas, there would be Prius factories in 3 different states in America today. Plus, the U.S. Treasury, not the world's petro dictators, would have gotten the extra dollar or two a gallon. That lingering uncertainty about the long-term price of oil is why some of our biggest energy companies, the kind you want to be all in on clean tech innovation, are not all in. You've seen those poker games on TV when the guy from Las Vegas, wearing sunglasses and his baseball cap backward, takes his whole pile of chips and says, "All in." And everyone around the room gasps. That is what we want to see America's best industrial innovation companies doing, pushing their piles of chips all in for innovation of clean electrons and energy efficiency systems. Yes, venture capitalism is important, but what is just as important are the bets that these giant companies make, because when they see a lasting, durable, and lucrative market for renewables, they can mobilize thousands of engineers, scientists, and researchers behind it. And with their global manufacturing and marketing abilities, they can get products to scale farther, wider, and faster than anyone. General Electric, DuPont, and Microsoft are America's premier engineering, chemical, biosciences, and software companies. And yet if you interview executives at all 3, they will tell you that when it comes to renewable energy, or in the case of Microsoft, energy efficiency software, they have not been all in. Too bad. Microsoft's research budget alone is about $6 billion, which is more than all the venture capital money that went into clean energy technologies in 2007, and triple the federal government's combined investments in energy efficiency and renewable energy R&D. All three of these companies are making bets on clean power and energy efficiency innovation, but they are still not as big as they could be. While they are all certainly intrigued and enticed to some degree by the ceiling price that crude oil has shot through, over $140 a barrel, what will make them go all in would be a floor price on crude oil or carbon content that would tell them and their investors that the price of these fossil fuels will never again fall below a certain level. As Kenneth Oyer, the MIT expert on innovation, likes to say, price fluctuations are not the same as high prices. Just because oil may have soared to $140 a barrel doesn't mean that one good recession or one big discovery off the coast of Brazil can't send the price tumbling again and wipe out investments in alternative energy. It's why companies like GE and DuPont focus not on the ceiling price of oil, but on the floor. GE's Jeffrey Immelt put it best. The big energy players are not going to make a multi-billion dollar 40-year bet on a 15-minute market signal. That just doesn't work. Big industrial players like GE need some price certainty if they are going to make big, long-term bets on clean power. And to those market dogmatists who say that the government should not be in the business of fixing floor prices or other incentives to stimulate clean power, Immelt says, get real. Don't worship false idols. The government has its hand in every industry. If we have to have them, I'd prefer they were productive rather than destructive. Those governments that have figured this out have benefited enormously already. The one clean power area where GE is now into a third-generation innovation is wind turbines, thanks to the European Union, Immelt said. Countries like Denmark, Spain, and Germany imposed portfolio standards for wind power on their utilities, requiring them to produce a certain amount each year and offered long-term subsidies. This created a big market for wind turbine manufacturers in Europe in the 1980s, when America abandoned wind because the price of oil fell. We grew our wind business in Europe, said Immelt. Right now, about half the states in the United States have renewable energy mandates that require their utilities to acquire a certain amount of power from solar, wind, hydro, geothermal, or biofuels, but each state has a different standard. Congress tried to pass a uniform national standard for the whole country in 2007, but it was defeated. If you had a national renewable energy mandate that covered all 50 states, that would tell me that there is going to be so much demand for wind or solar or geothermal so you can really make a big bet, said Immelt. When the Minister of Energy and Environment in Europe said to me in 2000 there was going to be 10% renewables all across Europe, that is what got the wind industry going there. You have to build the certainty that demand is going to be there. We will take the technical risk, we will fund the technology breakthroughs, but I have to know that if I make it work, there is a $20 billion market that I can step into. That is what has not existed in energy, but has existed in healthcare and in aviation. You know you have a market. This has been a big problem holding back nuclear power. What scares us is making these big R&D bets and not knowing if we will ever get an order. It doesn't much matter where the government sets a floor price for crude oil or gasoline, whether it is $80 a barrel or $4 a gallon, said Chad Holliday, the DuPont CEO. The important thing is that it be a credible floor. Then my investors say, I know that you are not wasting my money. The market is certain. If they set the market, all I have to do is show the investor that the technology is real. That takes away half the problem. I am talking to investors all the time. They keep saying to me, what if all this goes away? We need some reasonable certainty. We used to own an oil company, Conoco, and we concluded that we could not be a great oil company and a great science company, so we decided to sell Conoco. I paid the three best consulting companies in the world to tell me what the price of crude oil was going to be. They assured me that it could not go over $24 a barrel, or that the probability was very small. Today, the market is not sure where the oil price is going to go. Just like it is way up there now, no one can assure it will not go back down. That is why Jeff Immelt and I are arguing that there has to be a cost for carbon, no matter how you create it. There has to be a simple price signal. In 2007, Holiday gave me a concrete example. We have about 100 scientists working on cellulosic ethanol, which is ethanol made from waste or switchgrass, not from food crops. My guess, he added, is that we could double the number and add another 50 to start working on how to commercialize it. It would probably cost us less than $100 million to scale up. But I am not ready to do that. I can guess what it will cost me to make it and what the price will be, but is the market going to be there? What are the regulations going to be? Is the ethanol subsidy going to be reduced? Will we put a tax on oil to keep ethanol competitive? If I know that, it gives me a price target to go after. Without that, I don't know what the market is, and my shareholders don't know how to value what I am doing. You need some certainty on the incentive side and on the market side, because we are talking about multi-year investments, billions of dollars, that will take a long time to take off, and we won't hit on everything. Some will dismiss this as corporate whining. I don't. Energy innovation is hugely expensive, and you are always competing against an existing, cheap, dirty alternative. Put in a floor for crude oil, natural gas, and gasoline in America, or a permanent tax on carbon to lift the price of coal, and you will see the ceiling that has existed on energy innovation blow right off. Government is a huge player in healthcare, with huge subsidies, said Immelt. Cancer will be cured in our lifetime because of that. Why not in renewable energy? Other countries have certainly figured that out. We would like to go quickly to next-generation photovoltaics for solar, said Holiday. The governments of Hong Kong and Singapore found out about it, and both are pursuing us heavily with incentives to build the plant in their cities. Why isn't the United States doing that? I'm out in Hong Kong, and the new governor of Hong Kong shows up at our meeting, uninvited ahead of time, just to tell us, this is really important. You have to be in Hong Kong. I know Singapore is talking to you, but you need to be here. The U.S. bureaucracy is just not doing this kind of thing. Bottom line, America needs an energy technology bubble, just like the information technology bubble. In order to get that, though, the government needs to make it an absolute no-brainer to invest in renewable energy. Sure, we'll waste some money. Yes, there will be plenty of people who go bust along the way. But in the end, we will transform our economy and save ourselves from so many other problems in the process. Right now, in America, we have a bubble in stories about clean energy, but we do not have a clean energy bubble. The amount of venture capital in clean energy in 2007 was less than $5 billion. The amount of venture capital that went into the dot-com boom at its height in 2000, $80 billion. If $5 billion fell off the table in the dot-com bubble, nobody even bothered to pick it up. I first learned about the value of bubbles from Bill Gates at the Davos World Economic Forum in 1999. I wrote about the impromptu tutorial he delivered there in my book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree. Gates was giving his annual Davos press conference on the state of Microsoft and technology innovation. At the time, the internet bubble was at gale force. All the reporters there kept asking him variations on the question, "Mr. Gates, these internet stocks, they're a bubble, right? Surely they're a bubble. They must be a bubble?" Finally, an exasperated Gates said to the assembled reporters, "Of course they're a bubble, but you're all missing the point. This bubble is going to attract so much new capital to this internet industry that it is going to drive innovation faster and faster." Indeed, it was precisely the overexuberance of the dot-com bubble that led to the overinvestment of billions of dollars into fiber optic cable from the late 1990s to the early 2000s, which accidentally wired and flattened the world, making internet connectivity virtually free for everyone. That infrastructure was paid for largely by American and European investors. Many of them ended up losing their shirts in the dot-com bust, but the wired world they left behind made it possible for Indians, Chinese, Brazilians, and others from the developing world to compete, connect, and collaborate more cheaply and easily than ever before in history. The dot-com bubble funded so much innovation during the 1990s that in just a decade, it spawned the Internet World Wide Web e-commerce ecosystem that became the IT revolution. Economists have long known that bubbles, despite the money they waste and the grief they cause, can drive innovation at a fever pitch and finance the wires and plumbing that pave the way for the next big boom, bubble, and bust. The Newsweek economic writer Daniel Gross wrote a book about this phenomenon called POP, Why Bubbles Are Great for the Economy, which underscores the economic logic of bubbles and makes the argument that they have actually been a key driver of America's remarkable record of economic growth and innovation. Sure, he argues, most early investors went bust in the railroad or telegraph bubbles, but the infrastructure they left behind vaulted our economy forward. Gross, not surprisingly, also contends that the best way to trigger a real breakthrough in alternative energy would be to trigger a real energy bubble. It worked with IT. It can work with ET. Prices as a break on bad behavior. But there is another reason beyond the necessity of innovation for a healthy society to want to reshape the energy market with taxes and regulations. It's called life and death, or stability and instability. This is becoming a survival issue. Quite simply, continuing with the dirty fuel system in a world that is hot, flat, and crowded will drive all five trends shaping the energy climate era: energy supply and demand, climate change, petro-dictatorship, biodiversity loss, and energy poverty to unmanageable extremes. We need the market to send different signals. The legendary environmentalist Lester Brown, in his excellent book Plan B 3.0, quotes Øystein Dahl, former vice president of Exxon for Norway and the North Sea, as observing, "Socialism collapsed because it did not allow the market to tell the economic truth. Capitalism may collapse because it does not allow the market to tell the ecological truth." What he meant, of course, is that the basic paradigm of modern industrial age capitalism, which flowered in the 19th and 20th centuries, treated things like pollution, waste, and CO2 emissions as essentially irrelevant externalities that could be ignored. As any economics textbook will tell you, an externality is any cost or benefit resulting from a commercial transaction that is borne by or received by parties not directly involved in the transaction. A factory that pours pollution and CO2 into the atmosphere and toxic waste into the river is a classic example. Let's say that the factory makes toys. Those toys will be priced at the cost of labor and materials, plus a markup for profit. The two parties in the transaction are the manufacturer and the consumer. But there is an externality that is being paid for by some third parties, global society and planet Earth, and that externality is the short and long-term health consequences of polluting the air, poisoning the river, and intensifying global warming by making those toys with coal-fired power and toxic chemicals. We have been fooling ourselves with fraudulent accounting by not pricing those externalities. As Lester Brown put it, we as a society have been behaving just like Enron, the rogue energy giant, at the height of its folly. We rack up stunning profits and GDP numbers every year, and they look great on paper because we've been hiding some of the costs off the books. Mother Nature has not been fooled. That is why we are having climate change. That which is not priced is not valued, and if our open lands, clean air, clean water, and healthy forests are not valued, the Earth, when it is this flat and this crowded, will become a very hot, no-cost landfill very fast. When markets underprice goods and services by failing to price their externalities, and the impact of that underpricing has highly negative economic, health, and national security implications, it's the job of government to step in and shape the market to correct that failure. How can the invisible hand of markets be a rational allocator of resources if it is blind to the externalities? Asks Ray Anderson, founder and chairman of the eco-sensitive carpet manufacturers Interface, Inc. The government used a combination of taxes and education to get millions of people to stop smoking cigarettes and guzzling alcohol, and it needs to do the same thing to get the economy to stop smoking carbon and guzzling gasoline. Our economic, physical, and geopolitical health depends on it. What kind of price signal? So if those are all the reasons to create a price signal, what are the strengths and weaknesses of each? The options discussed most often are a carbon tax, a gasoline tax, feebates, an indirect tax through a cap-and-trade system, and a renewable energy mandate. I would be happy to see us move in any of these directions, as long as the effective tax is high enough and long-term enough to really change behavior. Under a cap-and-trade program, the government sets an overall cap on the level of CO2 emissions the United States economy would put into the atmosphere by a certain date. This cap would define the absolute maximum amount of CO2 that could be emitted in the United States. Over time, this cap would be reduced, resulting in fewer CO2 emissions and higher CO2 emission costs. Each business would receive, either through issuance or auction, tradable allowances equal to their maximum allowable level of CO2 emissions. Those firms that can reduce their emissions more cheaply and efficiently could sell their unused allowances to others who would otherwise have to pay more to comply. A cap-and-trade system was how the U.S. eventually controlled acid rain pollution, although there were far fewer players involved. Eileen Clausen, president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change, argues that a cap-and-trade is preferable to a carbon tax on a number of grounds. To begin with, while a tax provides for cost certainty, cap-and-trade provides for environmental certainty, she said. The cap is fixed by the government on the basis of what scientists tell us is the level of emissions we need to get to in order to protect the climate. The danger with a tax, Clausen argued, is that some people will just pay it, as they now pay higher gasoline prices, and still go out and buy a Hummer that pours more CO2 into the atmosphere. And, as everyone knows, new taxes are also very difficult to get through Congress, especially a tax that might actually bite enough to make a difference on CO2. Also, a cap-and-trade system does give the government a little more flexibility. It can, initially, adjust the allocations to utilities and businesses that are heavily dependent on coal, and therefore would get hit hardest, to ease their transition to a low-carbon economy. For a cap-and-trade system to work, though, you also have to have a serious price tag on spewing carbon, at least $30 per ton of CO2 emissions. Advocates of a carbon tax see things differently. I lean their way. They argue that a tax is preferable to a cap-and-trade regime because it is simpler, more transparent, and easier to calculate, and that it would cut across the whole economy and could easily be adjusted to ease the burden on at least lower-income workers by lowering or eliminating their payroll taxes. Tax advocates argue that an economy-wide cap-and-trade system would be more complicated to implement and would invite all kinds of lobbying for special exemptions. Beyond the complexity, the big thing that bothers me about cap-and-trade is that it feels like a hide-the-ball strategy, which is precisely the kind of thinking that has gotten us into this problem. People need to know that we are in a new era that will require systemic change. But the whole point of a cap-and-trade regime is to disguise any pain and pretend that we aren't even imposing a tax. To my ear, it is like trying to desegregate the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, in 1962 by letting James Meredith go to night school. That never would have worked. He needed to march right through the front door in broad daylight, and people needed to see that. It changed everything. So it is with the carbon tax. The price signal we need on carbon is not just about financial engineering to change economic behaviors. It is also meant to change the perception of where we are as a country and a species. It can't be disguised. We have to go from "this is the best we can do" to "this is how we are going to do it best." That said, whichever system can get through Congress quickest without being watered down, I will gladly embrace. Some have argued that a carbon tax would disadvantage the American economy by making our exports more expensive and less competitive. I disagree. To begin with, there are many things that go into the price of exports, most important, the value of your currency. Second, several European countries, like Denmark and Norway, have long had CO2 taxes. Denmark today is the world's leading exporter of wind turbines and has an unemployment rate of about 2%, in part because the way it has taxed energy has helped to stimulate a whole new clean tech industry there. Finally, if America were to put on a carbon tax and say China didn't follow suit, it would not take long for Congress to impose a carbon tariff on Chinese exports made with dirty fuels. As for gasoline, there are several sensible approaches. One is the price floor I suggested earlier. The energy economist Philip Verliger Jr. has proposed phasing in a gasoline tax, $5 or $10 a gallon, and using that money to reduce payroll taxes and to create a government fund that would buy back gas guzzlers and crush them. Many consumers are now stuck with big cars that they cannot afford to trade in for smaller, more fuel-efficient ones. The best monument to 9/11 we could erect would be a mountain of crushed gas guzzlers, said Verliger. Amory Lovins, the renowned environmentalist who co-founded the Rocky Mountain Institute, has proposed a system of feebates on automobiles to discourage people from buying gas guzzlers and to encourage them to purchase fuel-efficient cars instead. Within each size class, new car owners pay a fee or get a rebate, which and how big depend on a car's efficiency, and the fees pay for the rebates, said Lovins. The increased price spread encourages a buyer to buy an efficient model of the size he or she prefers. The buyer saves money, automakers make more profit, national security improves. It is hard to imagine anything with more positive impacts than increasing the gasoline tax in the United States, where gasoline still costs less than half of what it does in Europe, thanks to the heavy taxes there. Gasoline taxes help reduce consumption, shift people to more fuel-efficient vehicles, shrink the amount of money we send to petro-dictators, improve the air quality, strengthen the dollar and the balance of payments, help mitigate global warming, and give citizens a feeling they are contributing something to the war on terrorism. This is not just a win-win, said the Johns Hopkins foreign policy expert Michael Mandelbaum. This is a win-win-win-win-win. Another effective price signal, as Jeffrey Immelt noted, would be a national renewable energy mandate. Such a mandate would tell power companies in every state that by a certain date, say 2020, they would by law have to generate 20% of their power from renewable energy. Solar photovoltaic, solar thermal, hydro, wind, wave, or any other clean process. A renewable mandate like that would stimulate massive amounts of innovation because it would take existing technologies like wind and solar and push them quickly down the learning curve by creating a huge national market that would be a sure thing for investors to dive into. The politician who actually proved that best was a guy named George W. Bush when he was governor of Texas. He pushed and signed the Texas Renewable Portfolio Mandate in 1999. The mandate stipulated that Texas power companies had to produce 2,000 new megawatts of electricity from renewables, mostly wind, by 2009. What happened? A dozen new companies jumped into the Texas market, including one from Ireland, and built wind turbines to meet the mandate. So many that the 2,000 megawatt goal was reached in 2005. So the Texas legislature upped the mandate to 5,000 megawatts by 2015, and everyone knows they will beat that too. Renewable energy mandates work. Finally, we built over 100 nuclear power plants in the quarter century before 1979, when the accident at Three Mile Island brought a halt to all nuclear plant building in America. We need to do the same thing again, and we need to go on a crash program to extend the life of those nuclear plants we've already built. The threat of a nuclear leak with today's new technology is much less serious than the threat from climate change. But to build a new nuclear plant costs a minimum of $7 billion today and would take probably 8 years from conception to completion. Most CEOs have about 8 years in office, and there are not a lot of utility CEOs who would bet $7 billion, which might be more than half their company's market cap, on one nuclear project. For many utilities in prior decades, the construction of nuclear plants became a you-bet-your-business proposition, leading to the demise or economic crippling of utilities like the Long Island Lighting Company and the Public Service Company of Indiana. Therefore, because of the risks of lawsuits and delays, it is probably going to take, at a minimum, government loan guarantees to relaunch America's nuclear industry. Read my lips. The best way to fully appreciate the scope of the challenge we face in shifting to a clean energy system is to reread your Machiavelli. My favorite passage in The Prince goes like this. It ought to be remembered that there is nothing more difficult to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success than to take the lead in introducing a new order of things, because the innovator has for enemies all those who have done well under the old conditions, and lukewarm defenders in those who may do well under the new. This coolness arises partly from fear of the opponents, who have the laws on their side, and partly from the incredulity of men, who do not readily believe in new things until they have had a long experience of them. This is one more reason we need government to set a price signal to stimulate energy innovation. When you're moving from one system to another, the first step is always painful and more expensive than the status quo, and in a world that is hot, flat, and crowded, it is going to become more painful and more expensive every year that we wait. A price signal would spur the public and businesses to make the transition sooner rather than later. But our leaders have been afraid to lead. As a result, we have really moved only when external forces, like the 1970s Arab oil embargo, have caused enough pain and long enough gas lines that our leaders felt they had the political cover to do the right thing and order a doubling of fuel economy for American cars. Who will tell the people? Yes, I know the experts say that asking the public to pay a tax without a short-term benefit is a political impossibility. Yet, in the past, on the big issues like women's suffrage and civil rights, the public was out ahead of the politicians. And politicians can underestimate the public's willingness to do the right thing when it's clear what the right thing is and what the true costs and benefits of the alternatives really are. It's all about framing. Let's imagine an election campaign in which one candidate favors a gasoline tax and the other opposes it. The anti-tax candidate would say what such candidates have been saying for decades. There goes my liberal opponent again, demanding yet another tax. He's never seen a tax he didn't like. Now he wants to raise your gasoline taxes or impose some crazy tax on carbon dioxide. God bless our country. The American people have been taxed quite enough, thank you. But there is an answer to that. And a true green candidate would not shy away from it. He or she would say this. The American people certainly have been taxed quite enough. I totally agree. Right now they are being taxed by Saudi Arabia, taxed by Venezuela, taxed by Russia, taxed by Iran, and if we stay on this track, they'll soon be taxed by Mother Nature. And when Mother Nature starts taxing us, there will be no politician you can call on the phone to get relief. So let's get one thing straight. My opponent and I are both for a tax. I just have this quaint, old-fashioned view that my taxes should go to the U.S. Treasury, not the Saudi Treasury, not the Iranian Treasury, not the Venezuelan Treasury, and not the Russian Treasury. It's just a little tick I have. I like my tax dollars to go to build my own country. Think about this. The price of gasoline on the morning of September 11th, 2001 was between $1.60 and $1.80 a gallon in America. Had President Bush imposed a $1 a gallon Patriot tax the next day, gasoline would have been close to $3 a gallon. The U.S. government would have gotten the revenue boost, demand for gasoline would have fallen, and demand for more fuel-efficient vehicles would have soared. It would not be out of bounds to speculate that even with the rising demand from China and India over the past 7 years, gasoline at the pump in America today would be $3 to $4 a gallon, but we would already have been through the transition. Many more Americans would be driving much more fuel-efficient cars, like Europeans do, so their actual mileage per tank of gasoline would be dramatically better. And the U.S. Treasury, rather than the Iranian Treasury, would be getting the extra dollar in the gasoline price. But because we did not have the courage to make that transition on September 12, 2001, gasoline on September 12, 2008 was more than $4 a gallon. The fuel economy of American cars was still lousy, and the billions of dollars we've paid out due to the doubling of gasoline prices since September 11th has all gone to the oil producers, including governments that have drawn a bullseye on our backs. If we continue to do nothing in a world that is hot, flat, and crowded, we could easily see gasoline go to $5 or $6 a gallon in America. That will certainly stimulate a transition, a real spur to innovation, a real change in consumer buying habits, and probably even more mass transit. But precisely because we have waited so long to act, the cost of this transition to the average American will be wrenching. It already is, and politically destabilizing. Lord only knows what the impact will be in poor and developing countries. Every decade we look back and say, if only we had done the right thing 10 years ago. Well, my fellow Americans, all we need to do to guarantee that we slowly become a second-rate country is to once again keep postponing doing the right things for another decade. We baby boomers grew up in an age when all we had to do to maintain our way of life was leverage and exploit the abundant natural resources we inherited. Going forward, if we want to maintain our way of life, we will have to leverage and exploit our intellectual resources through innovation and technology. And the only way to do that is to shape the market differently. I am convinced that most Americans will pay more for energy if they are convinced that doing so will give them cars, homes, and appliances that will dramatically lower their energy consumption and contribute to a real nation-building strategy. If that argument can't carry the day, then we really are lost. Chapter 12. If it isn't boring, it isn't green. So here's a little news quiz. Which city in Pennsylvania has a trade surplus with China, Mexico, and Brazil? Answer: Erie. How could an old-line blue-collar manufacturing city like Erie have a trade surplus with China, Mexico, and Brazil? Answer: One company, GE Transportation. Well, what does GE Transportation make in Erie that is so exportable? Answer: It makes big old locomotives, those huge industrial-sized diesel engines that pull long trains. So how did GE Transportation, located in the former heartland of American manufacturing, now the heartland of America's Rust Belt, become the most profitable maker of locomotives in the world? Answer: A combination of great engineering by a traditional American company in a traditional American town, a global market looking for cleaner locomotives, and a U.S. government that demanded higher and higher standards. Those high standards helped to drive the innovation of a big train engine that spewed out less pollution while also increasing fuel economy and thereby lowering CO2 emissions in the bargain. And it is that interaction between government regulators and corporate managers and engineers, that dull, gray, boring interaction about standards, that is essential on a grand scale if we are going to spur the innovation we need to have a real green revolution. Sure, everyone wants to be an eco-star. Knowledgeable eco-stars like Al Gore are critical. They draw attention and passion to an issue. But they make a difference only if they are followed up by revolutionary bureaucrats, men and women who write emissions and efficiency standards, and who, with a flick of a pen, can change how much electricity 50 million air conditioners consume or how much diesel 1,000 locomotives guzzle in 1 year. That's revolutionary. When it comes to implementing a green revolution, the more boring the work, the more revolutionary its impact. If it isn't boring, it isn't green. I call this the Naked Gun 2.5 rule, after the brilliant but wacky movie by that name, starring Leslie Nielsen. Nielsen plays Lieutenant Frank Drebin, a bumbling police detective who uncovers a plot to sabotage America's energy policy. The movie opens at a dinner being given by President George Herbert Walker Bush, and in attendance at the White House are the leaders of the American energy industry, the representatives of the Society of Petroleum Industry Leaders, SPIL, the Society for More Coal Energy, SMOKE, and the Key Atomic Benefits for Mankind Nuclear Group, KABOOM. The president has decided to base U.S. energy policy on whatever a top independent expert, Dr. Albert S. Meinheimer, recommends. Solar energy is also in the running and coming on strong. The oil, coal, and nuclear industries plot to kidnap Dr. Meinheimer and replace him with a stooge who will recommend oil, coal, and nuclear power, not solar power, for America's future. Nielsen exposes the plot and confronts the head of the oil industry, telling him, "You are part of a dying breed, like people who can name all 50 states." Dr. Meinheimer is saved, and in the end, he recommends to President Bush a policy based on energy efficiency and clean, renewable energy sources. The Natural Resources Defense Council was actually an advisor on the film. My favorite scene comes at the conclusion. It's a press conference at the National Press Club, and Dr. Meinheimer is on stage explaining the intricacies of the renewable energy policy he is recommending. He is pointing to various charts, graphs, and statistics to buttress his analysis, and the entire audience and all the waiters have fallen dead asleep and are snoring away. If it isn't boring, it isn't green. Regulations and standards matter, even if they do put you to sleep. While it is absolutely necessary that we impose price signals in order to move the clean power technologies we already have down their learning curves, and in order to stimulate the market to search for new ways to give us abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons to feed an energy internet of smart grids, smart homes, and smart cars, price signals alone are not sufficient. And the next great clean power breakthroughs could take years to deploy. That is why we also need breakthroughs in energy efficiency and the efficient use of natural resources so we can get more growth, more mobility, more heat, more light, and more power from fewer energy and natural resource inputs right away. That will enable us to reduce CO2 emissions now, even before we have abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons. And that will enable us to use fewer clean electrons as they do become available. That is why, in a nutshell, the right energy policy today really comes down to this. We need to nurture all the cost-effective energy efficiency we can get right now, because that is always cheaper than generating new electrons. And at the same time, we need to nurture the cheapest emissions-free electrons to fill in the rest of our energy needs so we can grow in the cleanest way possible. As the last chapter focused on the role price signals can play in developing such a policy mix, this chapter will focus on how we can use these standards and regulations to stimulate deployment and innovation of clean electrons, to improve energy efficiency in the homes, appliances, buildings, vehicles, lights, and heating and cooling systems that would make up the smart grid, and to reshape how electric utilities relate to their customers so utilities can become optimizers of the entire energy internet rather than just operators of cheap, all-you-can-eat electron buffets. When it comes to the role of regulation in stimulating energy efficiency innovation, there is no better example than GE Transportation, which employs 5,100 people, many of them engineers.